everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 243. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Adobe, so big thanks to them for making this week's show possible. And it is a short show this week. I have some family obligations to attend to, so there might not even be a podcast next week. I'm not sure yet. I'm just going to have to see how things pan out over the next few days. But on this week's show, we're going to have the news headlines with Mark Piper, who's filling in for Adam Boileau while he's overseas. Both Mark and Adam work for Insomnia Security, so I should say a big thank you also to Brett Moore, who runs Insomnia Security, for letting the guys come onto the show to take time out of their working day to come onto the show. In addition to the news, we're also going to chat with Adobe's Director of Product Security and Privacy, Brad Arkin, in this week's sponsor interview. We're talking to him all about an opinion piece that Bruce Schneier wrote for Forbes, which is about twisted incentives in the vulnerability sales market. It is very interesting stuff. That's coming up in this week's sponsor interview. But right now, it's time to get into this week's news headlines with our good buddy, Mark Pipes Piper. And Mark, last week during the news, it was we discussed Julian Assange's last ditched appeal against his appeal against his appeal against appeal against appeal. So it really looked like he was destined for Sweden, and we thought, well, that's it. He's really going to have to go into court in Sweden and fight these allegations, even if they bother charging him. I mean, he just has to turn up for questioning. Yet no.
He got on a car and drove to the Ecuadorian embassy in London and seeked political asylum.
It's funny, actually. I remember once he was quoted in a BBC radio interview. He said that for him it was a real privilege to be messianic, without dying. So to be like a martyr, which apparently to Julian Assange means seeking political asylum in a warm place where there's lots of beautiful women.
Yeah, look, this is classic, right? Like, his lawyer's like, I found out that he sought political asylum at the embassy after he got there and gave me a call. Mm. So this hasn't really been particularly well thought out from the legal standpoint that they have. And as far as Britain's concerned, they don't give a shit. They are waiting outside the door. Literally, they have a little policeman sitting outside the door waiting for him to walk out. And they're going to arrest him as soon as he does.
It's funny, I mean, I think, as we were chatting, we were chatting before we started recording this, and we said, you expressed to me that you just wondered if this is really farce, if it's really just turned into the Julian Assange ego show. And I saw a tweet fired off from his account a couple of hours ago, which may or may not confirm this. But it was a retweet by someone from someone else, which said, and I'm quoting here, "It's great to see Aung San Suu Kyi in the UK, but she needs to know about Britain's own house arrest and detention without trial cases."
I don't even know what to say to that, right? Like, where do you begin?
Yeah.
Where do you begin?
Yeah, he's sort of comparing himself to Aung San Suu Kyi, so
it's a classic.
It is a bit of a classic, but I suspect that this asylum bid will not be successful, mostly because, sexual assault or sexual molestation or whatever it is that he's wanted for questioning over isn't actually a political crime.
No, it isn't. I'm sure it'll be over in a couple of hours.
Yeah, look, and there's been a lot of furfies flying about on this one. Like, he said that he's been abandoned by the Australian government and that they would extradite him. It's actually the stated and demonstrated policy of the Australian government that they do not, under any circumstances, extradite someone to face a capital crime. I mean, there was a guy, Gabe Watson from Alabama, who was convicted of the manslaughter of his wife in Queensland. The Queensland prosecutors would not send over evidence related to the case so that Alabama prosecutors could get him for conspiracy over there until they took the death penalty off the table. And this is a guy who drowned his wife, you know what I mean? So it's it's really, I just think there's a lot of funny information flying around here. And I expect that this time next week, he's probably going to be in Sweden.
Yeah, we'll probably talk about it then as well.
Indeed, indeed. Now, Tango Down or not, Ignazi have apparently claimed credit for a Twitter outage, but Twitter's statements on the incident say that it was likely just some sort of cascading failure or outage. They didn't mention any sort of DOS.
Yeah, I mean, this is, largely one of the big problems with security news is at the moment, whenever a site goes down through any reason whatsoever, if you say, I did it, the chances are that everyone's going to believe you did it. And saying that, the nature of the bug that Twitter have described, saying, it starts at one place and sort of cascades down and takes servers out as it goes, could potentially be started by some sort of nefarious activity, but there's no evidence, right? Like, these guys on Twitter haven't come out and said, yep, here's the sort of attack we ran, here's how we did it. Twitter's not offering up any information about exactly what sort of the nature of the bug was that caused the cascading failure. So at the moment, it's all sort of hearsay and being played out in the media.
Yeah, and the fact is Twitter might not even know how this failure was caused. They might not have even identified the single point of failure yet, you know, or the origin of the cascading failure. So they might not even know if this was a DOS.
Yeah, absolutely right. So, I mean, it's a classic, you know, when you run large-scale infrastructure, shit happens. And sometimes that can be caused by bad people, and sometimes it can be caused just by developers, right? Like, so you just got to be careful and see how it goes.
Indeed, indeed. Now, turning to Japan, and I tell you what, those Japanese with the cryptos, they're pretty good.
Yeah, 923-bit encryption has been cracked, apparently. They were talking about something about 148 days and 21 computers set to work on it. What isn't really clear from the article that I read was exactly, you know, what type of encryption it is and how, like, you know, it was being sort of coded and put together in various bits and pieces. But as far as, you know, cryptography research and cryptanalysis, this seems to be like pretty big deal, and a lot of people are going, hey, interesting.
Yeah, it's was Fujitsu Labs working with the National Institute of Informations and Communications Technology and Kyushu University in Japan, and it was an attack on pairing-based cryptography, which is apparently all the rage these days, and it took 148.2 days to crack a message. So they said that they, you know, had information on some weaknesses and had better brooding techniques and just sort of, yeah, basic cryptanalysis stuff. And they were, you know, really managed to bowl through it, which is a very big deal, TM. Now, moving to something a little less intelligent, a group of hackers took over the servers belonging to a company called AmeriCash. They're like a payday advance sort of, you know, short-term loan company. They grabbed all of their user data and said, give us 15 grand or we're going to expose it. The company said, no way, and their data's got dumped.
Yeah, pretty much. They hit them up. They stole the data. They said, can we please have 15 grand via fax, which I thought was particularly
old school.
Old school is good school. And then when the company said, no, instead we've reported you to the FBI, they dumped the info. And they said, look, you know, we support anonymous and activism and all the rest of it, but quite honestly, we're here for the cash. I'm pretty upfront about it. So.
Yeah. We're criminals. Give us your money.
Yeah.
You've got us mixed up with the other guys.
Yeah. The quote was, however, we're in it for the money, which is also pretty awesome.
Yeah.
End quote.
Now, look, this has got to be the epic fail of the week. Face.com. This is like the bug of bugs. This is about a week ago now. We missed it in last week's bulletin. But this Israel-based facial recognition technology maker, Face.com, there was a really, really shocking bug, which basically enabled really any man and his dog to take over any of their users' Twitter or Facebook accounts. This is just a shocker.
Yeah, this is pretty funny. So it was responsibly reported, which is the only saving grace at this stage, is the fact that they managed to patch it before it was publicized. But the Face.com have an application called Click, which is a mobile application, and that can integrate with your Facebook and Twitter accounts. So what happens is you authorize your Facebook account, for example, with Click, you'll get what's called an OAuth token back, and then Face.com stored the OAuth token in their cloud servers. Unfortunately, they also had an endpoint on their API where you could say, can I please have the information for any user on Face.com? And as part of that API response, they would return the OAuth token for that user.
Who comes up with these things? This is Failey the Fail Monster who came up with this.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of not unusual behavior for companies to store these sort of tokens, but it's pretty poor form to just publish that information back with user profile data.
To make it available over the internet. Yeah, no, not so good.
Yeah.
Not so good.
And it's going to be pretty interesting for Face.com, because I think at the same time it was announced that they've been acquired by Facebook.com for 50 to 100 million US, something like that. They're saying ballpark figure.
Better than a kick in the nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, at least, you know, Facebook product security will be all over that shit now, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they actually do have a team, don't they? So, yeah. God, embarrassing. Now, in moving to the least surprising news of the week, US and Israel apparently developed the Flame computer virus. Well, duh. I mean, we kind of were talking about that last week, but the Washington Post kind of has it on semi-record from well-placed officials that it was the NSA, the CIA, and the Israeli military that created Flame, which I don't think really surprises anyone.
Yeah, so I mean, basically, the way it's been looking is that there's some characteristics, and you know, some of the people doing forensic analysis of Flame have found commonalities between Stuxnet and Flame, and this has been increasing over the last couple of weeks. More and more little bits of the puzzle are fitting together. They don't necessarily mean that they were developed by the same teams, but there's definitely been some source code shared amongst them, and it's understood that, you know, Flame was used in conjunction with Stuxnet at some stage. What the Washington Post have done have come out and said, yep, we spoke to some people and it's all true. For me, it was kind of interesting because New York Times got the scoop on this last time, and I just wonder how much of it was the Washington Post wanting to get their scoop, like, you know.
Oh, look, if you could, so. I mean, they're not going to just make this sort of stuff up. I mean, the lead has got comma, according to Western officials with knowledge of the effort. I mean, these are journalists who are based in Washington who do have access to these sorts of sources, so I have no doubt the story is legit. What I find interesting is that those type of sources never give away that sort of information, even on background, even off record, without some sort of tacit approval from their higher ups. So there seems to have been a concerted campaign coming from inside the Beltway, so to speak, to let the public know through the media that this stuff is coming from the US government. And it is, you know, it reeks of election year maneuvering, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, I think we touched on this last week when we originally were discussing the Olympic game effort and the publication in the New York Times. And one of the things they do say in there is that, yes, like this, discussing this sort of stuff boosts Obama's position in the public eye as being a bit more aggressive than what he has appeared up until now.
He's not soft on those Iranians. I think that's what he's trying to go for. At least he's dropping packets and not bombs. I mean, with the exception of the drones thing, at least he hasn't invaded any countries. I mean, that's something, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a start, right?
4 years and the Yanks haven't invaded anyone. It's a miracle.
Yet.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we'll see. And here's an interesting story I spotted on Dark Reading. There's a worm going around that targets AutoCAD and is designed to steal plans and send them off to, you guessed it, China.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually kind of an interesting article that you stumbled across. I missed this completely. But yeah, basically the guys at ESET have been doing their analysis as they do, and what they found was a worm that had no centralized command and control that basically uses Lisp to self-propagate across the network and various hosts, and whenever it finds an AutoCAD instance, will infect it, and whenever it finds an AutoCAD document, will email it back to an address in China, or one of the 22 addresses in China. And it's been pretty successful. They've found it on at least 10,000 machines so far, and it's busily trucking along, stealing the plans.
Yeah, well, I mean, this reminds me of, what was that talk at KiwiCon a few years ago, Hacking Scientists, you know, which, and then there was Hacking Hollywood as well, which is really looking at this niche software. And, you know, it's not going to get the same sort of attention that Microsoft is giving its software, that Google gives Chrome. Do you know what I mean? This is really niche stuff that has a very small install base. It's basically impossible to secure. So I think we're going to see more of this sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other interesting thing on this point is that ESET have discussed is that it does not appear to be a targeted attack. This is not an advanced persistent threat, right? As far as they're concerned, this is just someone stealing all the AutoCAD data.
Yeah, someone might be a student who's looking to cheat on an exam, for all we know.
Maybe it's a new architecture firm forming out of Beijing or something.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Now, speaking of targeted attacks, a whole bunch of dissidents in Syria have been targeted by another remote access Trojan. Bad for them.
And not very sophisticated as well, right? The guys at Sidon Labs, Morgan Marquardt and Seth Hardy, have been looking into Syrian-based Trojans for some time now. And one of the ones they came across was this new one, which basically entices the user to install a dodgy Black Shades remote access Trojan, which is an off-the-shelf commercial Trojan. It's nothing extravagant. There's nothing targeted about it. But what's interesting that it fires away and connects to port 4444 somewhere within the Syrian telecommunications establishment.
But is that enough to prove that this is a government Trojan? I mean, well, still, you know, if I was a Syrian dissident, I wouldn't want to take the chance. But it is a little bit hard to pin it absolutely on the Syrian government, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, one of the major things here that really stands out is the lack of sophistication. Like, Black Shades is a Trojan you can buy on the internet for $50. Right. And its functionality is not very covert, such as that, you know, that we see in newer malware. It's, I think, more of the back office 2000 and that sort of stuff back, you know, in the 90s. It's the modern day version of that sort of software. But what is interesting is just the targets that it's been hitting, right? Like, so it has been targeted to individuals that are, you know, actively against, you know, the action that's currently going on in Syria. So.
Yeah, so it could be anyone from a government operative to just some sort of lone ultra-nationalist. You just don't know. But either way, that is not something you want on your system, especially when you're in a country that is descending into civil war. Hooray. No.
But thankfully, it's easy to detect, right? So, you know, give it another couple of weeks for the AVs to fully catch up and it should be, you know, straightforward detectable, so.
Well, Morgan's actually doing a talk about all of this stuff at Black Hat. Morgan, of course, is a Kiwi who is now based, he works for Google somewhere. I don't know if he's in Zurich or in the US these days. But yeah, interesting talk he's got about all of this sort of software that's targeting political activists and stuff. So if you're over there at Black Hat in a few weeks, you might want to check it out. Now, PayPal has actually started up, you know, much like Facebook and Google, has started up a bug bounty program for security research, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yep, so they're joining on the bug bounty bandwagon and they've said, yep, we're going to start paying for vulnerabilities. I think I saw someone say that already submitted seven cross-site scripts. But what they're saying is that, look, yep, we're going to pay you for vulnerabilities, but only across four categories. Cross-site scripting, CSRF, SQL injection, and authentication bypass. What's interesting is they're not offering the bug bounty for more severe bugs such as, you know, remote code execution.
Well, I mean, there's a pretty obvious reason behind that, which is that if you start giving people permission to, or tacit permission to allow them to try to execute code on their servers, they start crashing your servers and you've got some pretty serious problems. What's interesting about this, as far as I can tell, though, is this is something that, you know, web-based companies, large web-based organizations in the US are doing, you know, Google, Facebook, now PayPal, I think eBay maybe, I can't remember. But I'm wondering if it's time for an organization perhaps like OWASP to create a boilerplate policy that organizations can use if they want to. So if you're, you know, running some large organization, like say a bank here in Australia, and you know, you want to know about these sorts of vulnerabilities in your website, that you can publish a boilerplate document that says how much you're offering for what is allowed and what is not. I'm thinking is a pretty cost-effective way of doing some QA. Do you think there's a requirement for that?
I mean, it would be nice, right? I mean, the big problem isn't so much ever saying, hey, we're going to pay for these sort of bugs. The big problem usually is handling that internally. How are we going to respond? Who's going to be escalated? How are we going to deal with these sort of attacks, right? So places like PayPal and Google have that process down pretty packed, right? Like they've done it for a long time. But a lot of the newer, larger websites, and we've seen this like recently with the likes of Tumblr, right? Obviously need more assistance or more experience on how to respond in general, let alone, you know, have to deal with the cash.
Yeah, but they're startups. I mean, I'm talking about established enterprises that you wouldn't traditionally think of as being online businesses. But these days, you know, online is a big part of what a banking organization does. It's a big part of what an insurer does. Surely you could sort of crowdsource the QA. You'd probably get better bang for your buck than going to pen testing firms.
Well, yeah, I mean, as far as Google's concerned, that's pretty much what they've come out and said as well, right? Like, I think they've paid out over $400,000 in the last couple of quarters or something like that. So it's a big case of, like, you know, just making sure that the organization can handle it, right? Because if you're not prepared to handle, you know, 15 serious issues coming through your door the week that you launch it, then you're going to be in serious trouble, right?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, you know, some of these financial services companies, that, I mean, they even have their own internal cert teams. So I don't know. I think it's an idea that eventually we're going to have to look at as an enterprise security measure in terms of just allowing. I mean, you might even have a boilerplate that says, look, we're not going to pay, but here's what you're allowed to do. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a bounty. It might just be about creating a bit of a playground for, you know, bored 18-year-olds to have a bit of a play.
Yeah. And I mean, it's definitely a trend that's coming through, right? It's like, okay, we're no longer going to go to the FBI when you come up with a bug against our site.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to actually work with you on it. So.
Now, speaking of other moves on the defensive side, Microsoft has revealed three finalists for the Blue Hat Prize. They're offering a $200,000 first prize for a technology that will defeat ROP exploits. So any sort of return-oriented programming exploits, they're looking for the most effective mitigation against that, and they're going to pony up $200,000. So there should be a winner announced soon.
Yeah, so I mean, I think what the original idea was to offer a prize for defensive technologies, right? Anything that's going to help improve the defensive position of Windows, as opposed to, you know, offering cash money for vulnerabilities, right? They said, all right, well, we're going to offer us some cash if you can help us come up with a better defense system. Naturally, all three finalists and pretty much a large number of the responses, I suspect, were all about mitigating ROP, right? Mitigating the way that some exploitation occurs on Windows. So it'll be interesting to see what, you know, comes out of this and whether or not we see a service pack release in the future or how it sort of ties in. But it's a pretty good move from Microsoft, right? They've got, like, you know, the potential to shut down a lot of bugs for the price of one.
Yeah, and I suspect if this is a success that the prize money is going to go up. At the moment, the finalists are Jared DeMott, Ivan Frantic, and Vasily Pappas. And I think these guys, yeah, we'll find out at Black Hat. That's where they're going to announce it. First prize is $200,000. Mm-hmm. Second prize is $50,000. And the third prize, it's like a booby prize, I swear to God. It's an MSDN subscription. You know, can you imagine being the third place guy? I'll tell you what to do with your MSDN subscription.
Yeah, I mean, sitting around Black Hat waiting for that to find out if you've got an MSDN subscription or 200K, like, you know, you'd probably want to find out at the beginning of your weekend, like, just not the end of it. But.
Yeah, no, not so good. I mean, that's guaranteed to get a very skilled computer scientist hating you forever. So maybe that's a part that they didn't quite think through. Now, LinkedIn is being sued to the tune of $5 million over its failure to adequately or appropriately hash passwords. You know, we see these sort of lawsuits popping up fairly regularly. They rarely succeed, but it is interesting to see these sorts of headlines being scattered around the place, because generally it's the sort of thing that gets the boardroom attention. It's similar organizations that might say, hey, you know, have we hashed our passwords correctly?
Yeah, and I mean, most of these usually end up being settled out of court as, please go away, you are annoying us, right? But yeah, I mean, whenever a lawsuit is involved against a major company and it's strung out over, like, you know, 1 or 2 years, yeah, other boards pay attention and they listen, right? So it'll be interesting to see if this does actually result in anything. Mm. I doubt it. It feels very just, you know, classic American, I can make some money here.
Yeah, well, it also looks like LinkedIn got pwned by, drumroll please, SQL injection. So no real surprise there.
Yeah, I mean, it's they're a website, right? They're a website. They have all the classic web vulnerabilities like everyone else, I'm sure. So are we going to see a lawsuit every single time a website gets popped? That'd be interesting to see.
I'm sure the lawyers would like to see that. Now, I don't know if you caught the news. There was some guy did a Pastebin post saying that he'd owned 79 banks and had a whole bunch of Visa and MasterCard information. He was going to drop it all and blah, 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 blah. And yeah, nothing's really happened there. No data has been forthcoming. It's completely fizzled. I just think this is funny that it was a story in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, you gave a great talk at KiwiCon a number of years back about how you can manipulate the media to get your name up there, right? And this is exactly the sort of thing, right? Like, so this guy comes out, he says he owned 79 banks globally. He has 50 gigabytes of information, and he posted a little teaser paste on Pastebin, and Visa and MasterCard came back and saying, look, that's not information we collect. We don't really care about it. Right. So, and he posted a teaser of some of the credit card info, like, that he had supposedly stolen from Visa and MasterCard on Pastebin, and Visa and MasterCard came back saying, look, that isn't information we collect. You didn't get it from us. And now he's sort of gone quiet.
Big surprise there. So, yeah, mm-hmm. It turns out probably full of shit. Mm-hmm. Now, here's an interesting little technical story. There is a vulnerability affecting some 64-bit systems because of a bug in Intel processors.
Yeah, look, architecture flaws are great, aren't they? They're absolutely fantastic once you've got your product out on the market, and then the guy that, you know, has basically architected Cubes OS, which is all about segregation from the and trust from within the CPU layer, comes out and says, hey, this entire range of Intel chipsets, 64-bit models have a bug where we can, you know, cause the CPU to execute instructions in a particular order, which, well, in itself is not that amazing, but it can be used for guest-to-host breakout in some instances. Mm. And, you know, products affected include, like, you know, sort of Zen, FreeBSD, NetBSD, and Microsoft, right? So VMware is not affected at this stage. VMware went away and analyzed it and came back. The hilarious thing about this story is the Zen security guys posted a triage of their response to this bug. And one of the interesting things that they didn't have in their policy was how to deal with architecture bugs.
It wasn't a
bug in any given real piece of software, right? It was a bug at an architecture layer on the CPU. So it kind of ended up going through CERT and Intel and having people look at it. So yeah, pretty nasty bug, but some interesting work by a guy who's been looking at this stuff for quite some time, right?
Yeah, so. And it looks like despite it being a hardware bug, it is something that can be mitigated in software if you're aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think pretty much every major vendor that's been affected by this has released a fix or a workaround, from what I understand. So.
Now, a few weeks ago, we saw a mass exodus of security researchers from the Zero Day Initiative, from ZDI. A whole bunch of them left. It was all over the Twitters. It was a big, you know, big bit of industry sort of gossip. A lot of those staffers have banded together to form a new company which is actually called, and this is, I love this, it's called Exodus Intelligence.
Yeah, I think more than a few people had a chuckle at that when they announced their sponsorship of Recon to announce their existence. So this is Aaron Portnoy and the team, who were formerly ZDI under HP. They've gone, set up Exodus. They're buying vulnerabilities under the new EIP program, very similar to the way that ZDI did it. But instead of feeding signatures back into their Tipping Point IDS product, they're now offering that information to subscribers of their service. So multiple product vendors and multiple intelligence firms or organizations can now subscribe and get ahead of time vulnerability information.
So it's more like the immunity model than the VUPN model.
Yeah, pretty much, right? So they're buying vulnerabilities, they're sharing that information amongst their subscriber base while at the same time working with the vendor to get the vulnerability resolved, right? They reckon they're paying market rates equivalent, and if anyone knows what, like, you know, ZDI is paying, it's these guys. And quite humorously, the first bug that's been submitted under the EIP program is a bug against some HP software.
Yeah, well, big surprise there. But Mark, that's actually it for this week's news. Thank you very much for filling in for Adam Bailo over the last couple of weeks, especially last week when you were feeling sick. I'm very glad you are feeling better, and I'm sure we'll chat to you again soon.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Pat.
That was Mark Piper of Insomnia Security with a look at the week's news headlines. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this week's podcast is brought to you by Adobe. Adobe has been sponsoring Risky Business all year, and I'm very happy to announce that they're going to continue sponsorship until at least the end of 2012. And we're absolutely thrilled to have them on board. Now, I've got to say, it's actually been very interesting for me to be able to do these sponsor interviews with Brad Arkin. Brad is, of course, Adobe's head of product security and privacy. Too often in the tech media, and I do include Risky Business in this, we wind up viewing things through a pretty sort of rigid InfoSec industry perspective. So the internal workings of security teams at large software development, you know, companies like Adobe are more or less completely opaque because we just don't often think to canvas the opinions of the builders. We're just more interested in the opinions of the breakers. Well, this is a week where we really needed the perspective of a builder. Bruce Schneier, who is a very prominent commentator, he wrote up an opinion piece for Forbes that said that the large sums paid by government buyers for zero-day vulnerabilities from bug hunters is basically incentivizing the deliberate sabotage of software by the people who are developing it. That way they can sort of turn around and sell the vulnerabilities that they put there to three-letter agencies. Now, that piece is called The Vulnerabilities Market and the Future of Security, in case you would like to find it and read it. Now, Brad disagrees with Schneier on his position on this, and I've got to say, Bruce's argument didn't quite pass the initial sniff test for me either. The business of buying and selling O-Day isn't as Wild West as people like Schneier think, mostly because trust is a big issue. If you're going to buy O-Day from someone, you want to make damn sure that they haven't sold it already to your adversary, or you may as well put neon signs all over your payloads. So the idea of three-letter agencies just buying bugs off shonky developers embedded in companies like Microsoft or Adobe or, you know, wherever, it just didn't seem plausible to me initially. But, you know, hey, in 5 years, who knows? Now, for an entirely different set of reasons, it didn't seem plausible to Brad either. And if there's someone likely to know how plausible something like this is, it is Brad. So I got him on Skype and started off by asking him if he agreed with Schneier's key assertion that this scenario is a risk. Here's what he had to say.
I don't. And I think the key distinction that Schneier missed in his piece is the distinction between a vulnerability and an exploit. And I was digging around and I found this great essay by a guy named Dave G, who's currently a founder at Modisano in New York. And I used to work with him at AtStake. We're in the New York office together. And he really laid out very nicely an argument, which I totally buy, that, you know, vulnerabilities are pretty much very low value, especially to software vendors or to people who are looking to perpetrate bad things against other, you know, victims or targets. And it's the exploits where the real value is. And, you know, you start with a vulnerability, which you might represent with a proof of concept crasher. And then to take that and find out if it's exploitable and then demonstrate that it's exploitable is a lot of work. And then from there, to take the exploit and make it reliable across a lot of different configurations and a lot of different platforms, and also very stealthy so that you're not going to alert the target that you've actually succeeded. That's where the real value is. And so if, the end consumer is, some nefarious organization that wants to procure this stuff, they want exploits. They don't want vulnerabilities because all the work happens after the vulnerability has been identified. And so if you've got
Surely, though, if we're talking about sabotage, it would be possible to insert vulnerabilities that are easier to exploit, which make, creating the exploit on the other end a lot less difficult.
Yeah, I to me that just doesn't feel very realistic for the scenario. So and I'll give you some examples. There's two ways to evaluate it. One is an existing employee who's trying to make a little bit of extra money on the side by selling bugs or creating bugs and then selling them. And most of the developers, given where they are within the code base, no code changes happen without some kind of peer review. And so you'd have to be a pretty subtle change in order to get through. And certainly possible. I mean, like you can cook up schemes where this would work, but the end result is that you would just have, a bad line of code, but there's already many, many, many bad lines of code in the code base to start with. And so I don't think people would pay very much for that kind of stuff. And then if you imagine something that's like a really effective backdoor, that's not going to be very subtle. It's more likely to get caught. And the consequences of getting caught, in my mind, wouldn't be worth it for the perpetrator, given how little value there is for that vulnerability in the first place. And I think it's a lot easier for people to look for bugs that are already in the code and then do the hard work of writing the exploit for it. I think from an organization that is looking to carry out these types of attacks. And he was really focused on the government side, like government buyers who would do this, and then the people who sell to government buyers. And those guys, they want that really stealthy, reproducible exploits or reliable exploits. And I don't feel like insiders are going to be well positioned to help with that as much.
Now, you're quite right in terms of this being unlikely within, a commercial development organization where there's peer review, especially where they have got any sort of SDL. A subtle change, doesn't really get you very far because there's already plenty of other vulnerabilities to choose from, and a glaring change is likely to be picked up in the QA process. Do you think it might be easier for this sort of thing to happen with open source projects?
I don't know. I mean, you've got within the open source world, you've got the whole commit record, and you can go back and see who's doing what. And even though open source projects, the folks may not work in the same building together, but for especially the widely distributed software, there's such a strong community there that people really know, even if it's not the first name, but they know the handle of who's doing this, and they know their style. And there's lots of peer review that happens, particularly for newcomers. And so to get in there and establish that reputation necessary to get to the point where you can do straight commits, it's just a lot of work for the end result.
But I
So
guess
I
the
don't.
point that Schneier's kind of making here is that there is a hell of an incentive now when people are paying 250 grand for a bug in iOS and, God knows how much for a bug in SSH. It almost creates that incentive and makes it worthwhile to become like a really valued contributor to that project so that you can then start subverting it. And then, it seems today to be a pretty implausible scenario. I mean, I give you that, but you could see how, if the price for bugs keeps rising, that it might actually create an incentive for people to go to those lengths. Or do you think that's just really
Well,
fanciful?
no, if you take things to their limit, I could imagine a day where that might happen. But I think, and you're making the same mistake that I accuse Schneier of here, is that you're referring to bugs, but it's really the exploits that people care about. And so inserting the bug itself might be interesting. If I'm willing to pay 250K for a reliable exploit that works against iOS, then maybe I'd be willing to pay 10K for a bug that might turn into a reliable exploit. But the bug itself is really a small part of the total stack of value there. It's all of the work that goes in once the bug's identified to then create that reliable exploit. So one thing which when I was looking at the Schneier article that jumped out at me is that he talked about the problem that now that these bugs have value and they're being moved around and sold to people who are going to use them to carry out attacks, and he made the point that it's a concern that it'll stay secret. But the problem with that assertion is that once you use a exploit to target an unknown vulnerability, it's no longer secret because the victim now has a copy of it, potentially, if they're paying attention. And, you know, for like the Stuxnet, Dooku, Flame, like all of those things, even though they're made attempts to be stealthy about it, eventually someone got a copy of it. And now that people know those techniques, they're going to be watching more carefully. They're going to be looking through the files.
I don't know, man. They did all right out of that. That was like 5 years before they got found out.
Yeah, but now, but they got found. And I'm sure that the day they, you know, commissioned the work, they had written on the whiteboard there as one of their requirements was to never be discovered. And then it got discovered. And the other thing is that if someone was very, very careful and they used a exploit a single time against a single target and then never again, you know, so they tried to be as stealthy as possible, then it's not being used anywhere else. And so the real world risk is pretty minimal because they're using it so sparingly.
Well, that's exactly right. And I myself was thinking along similar lines when I read that, which is like, oh no, government buyers buying vulnerabilities. It's like, well, a vulnerability is only a problem when people know about it. And when it's some super secret intelligence agency using it against a dozen people, you know, just don't be one of those dozen people, basically.
If the things that you're doing has put you in conflict with nation state adversaries, then, you know, you've got to be really conscious of that. And you know, just living your life like a regular internet citizen isn't going to cut it. You know, but for the billions of other people who are just regular internet users, then they're not in harm's way, really.
Going back to your point about exploitation and, you know, clean exploitation of this stuff. I mean, it was funny, isn't it? Because 10 years ago, we were in this world where, you know, if you could find a buffer overflow and there were zillions of them, you know, exploiting it was just a matter of stuffing shellcode into memory and away you went. These memory mitigations that operating system manufacturers and projects have inserted into their OSs have really bought us a great deal of protection, haven't they?
Yeah. And this is another, you know, sort of mini rant that I've got after reading this, was that the, you know, there's this focus on bugs and individual vulnerabilities. And in my mind, you know, code doesn't get better one bug at a time. And so the idea that if only the government were to buy this and give it to the software vendors and we'd fix it and everything would be perfect. The reality is that things get better through exploit mitigations, I think, in the real world. That to me is what's really moved the needle. And so you've got the OS platform mitigations. You've got people doing extra work on top of that, like what we did for the sandboxing, you know, which raises the bar even further. And that ability to put mitigations in place that knocks out or raises the difficulty for whole classes of bugs, that's how you really make the software better. And so in my mind, anything when you're arguing one bug at a time, it doesn't matter. It's noise.
No, I imagine that your sandboxing of, you know, Adobe Reader bought you a lot more in terms of, you know, number of hours spent on it than, you know, hiring a whole bunch of people to go through and look for individual like heap sprays or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've got really clean data on this because we did both. And, you know, throughout 2009 and 2010, we made huge numbers of changes that fixed individual bugs, you know, like very large numbers of individual bugs in version 9, and bad guys kept attacking it. And then we came out with 10. And the reason that we've seen all of the attacks against version 9 diminish was through mitigations where we turned things off by default, where we made exploit harder in version 9, or then in 10, where we just made general, you know, any type of memory corruption exploit a lot harder.
And have you actually looked at the actual price? I mean, because, you know, managing budgets and stuff is obviously a part of your job. Have you actually sat down with a pen and paper and figured out, you know, of those changes, like per bug, like eliminating, you know, a certain type of vulnerability in your code based through a certain type of scan, you know, and fixing the actual code versus the time spent actually, you know, introducing something like a sandbox? Have you actually sat down and worked out like a per vulnerability mitigated cost for each of those approaches?
Well, we've done a lot of numbers about how are we going to protect people the fastest with minimum investment on our side. You know, so the cheapest investment, best return, and then also cheapest investment is a proxy for calendar time. And so we want to get those protections out as quick as we can. And the thing is that like we could fix 10,000 bugs. But if it's just as easy for the bad guys to find the next bug and then write an exploit for it and carry on an attack, then it doesn't actually make the users any safer. And so like thinking on a per bug basis usually doesn't help very much. And so the metric that I work on, and it's a fuzzy metric, you know, we can't nail it down precisely, but it's what is the cost or how hard is it for an attacker to find a bug and then write an exploit for it that's going to achieve the ends that they desire. And we've got some good metrics on what it took for the IBM researchers that found a bug in the Reader 10 sandbox. And they showed this at Black Hat last summer, and they had two guys with help and input from, you know, friends and peers and colleagues and all that. And I think they spent 4 months and they found one bug, which was really like an edge case situation. And it was very easy for us to fix. But that level of effort compared to what it took against
to rattle out a buffer overflow that had just like, let your stuff shellcode into memory.
In order for us to achieve that same level of effort just by finding and fixing bugs would have required an unbelievable amount of, you know, fuzzer CPU time and then the 80 hours of work it takes to fix a bug, fix the regressions, do the testing, fix whatever else you just broke, you know, per bug, and then multiply that out. And it just doesn't, you can never get there just by finding and fixing bugs. It's the mitigations that makes the real difference. For perfect, we're just trying to drive the cost up. So that's the real goal for us.
This brings us closer to a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I mean, these memory bugs are getting very expensive. I mean, the sort of people who are writing exploits for memory bugs these days are extremely skilled researchers, these days often working not alone. You know, it used to be something that people could do alone. These days, it's more and more likely that you're going to be working within some sort of team, whether that's with one other researcher, you know, like these guys from IBM who found the bypass in the Adobe sandbox. Chances are you're not doing it alone. So I'm wondering, and I've always been a big fan of logic bugs as an attack vector, you know, just tricking software basically into doing what it is that you want it to do using undocumented features, even using documented features in unexpected ways. Do you think we're going to see a rise in that type of, you know, in that type of hacking, basically?
Yeah. No, I think we already have. So on the desktop side, we're still in that memory corruption world, you know, for most of the desktop threats that we see out there. But if you look at Flash Player in Chrome, for example, so Flash Player in Chrome has had a weak form of sandboxing in place for a while, and then that's been getting incrementally better. And then with the Pepper API that we roll out this summer, that'll be a lot better. But just that small hurdle that is already in place with Flash Player, there aren't any real-world exploits against Flash Player in Chrome that are memory corruption. They're all things like universal cross-site scripting. And so, you know, the nation state adversary wants to reach into the dissident's email and turn on the auto forward to some other address or something like that.
So if I'm a nasty flash object.
Yeah, yeah. And so that is something that we've already seen there. And it's not like it's impossible to carry out like the Vupin guys, I think, have done it. But it's in the ass, it's not worth it. And so the real world attacks that we've seen have shifted to these, you know, UXSS bugs. And then on the websites, you know, it's still theoretically possible that you could submit just the right kind of input that could lead to some memory corruption problem for, you know, a big public website, but there's absolutely no reason to do so. So you do SQL injection or other scripting bugs or something like that, because you can achieve the ends using the other techniques. And so in the web world, you know, I think we've already seen that happen. And then in the desktop side, we're starting to see that. So like the IBM guys and the work that they did, it wasn't a memory, they chained a memory corruption bug with, I guess you could call it a logic bug. It was just a screw up in where we'd place things in the trust boundaries.
Well, it's like Billy Rios from Google did a talk a couple of years ago at RuxCon called Will It Blend, which was like a bug chaining talk. And there wasn't a lot of memory corruption involved in that, you know, which was pretty cool. And, you see Stuxnet, the .lnk bug that actually got that onto systems was a complete, I mean, there was no memory corruption involved in that. That was, you know, stick a USB into any Windows box and own it just by asking Windows nicely to run your content, you know, you got to love. But Brad Arkin, we're actually out of time, but it's been a pleasure to chat to you as always, and we'll speak to you again in another 4 weeks.
All right. Thank you.
That was Adobe's Director of Security and Privacy, Brad Arkin, there with a chat about Schneier's recent Forbes piece. Big thanks to Adobe for sponsoring this week's show and indeed its continuing support through to the end of 2012. Thanks also to Virtual Office, that's OFFIS, for hosting the Risky Business website. Now, as I said at the top of the show, next week's podcast may not happen depending on how a few things play out, but I will let you know. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm just Risky Business. That is one word. So twitter.com/riskybusiness. And this week's track is by Marshall O'Kell. He was the frontman for Marshall and the Fro, but these days he is solo. I actually sat in with Marshall on keyboards last weekend at a gig that he did here in Byron, and he gave me a copy of his latest EP. So I'm going to play a track from it with permission. The EP is called Sugar, and it is available on iTunes here in Australia. This song is about Marshall getting the absolute shit kicked out of him in Ballina when he was 19 years old. And as you'll hear, there was a girl involved. It's called Almost Killed You, and my lovely niece, who is staying with me at the moment, picked this one out. I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
I thought I knew you, but clearly I don't. I thought you loved me, it was clearly a joke. You left me on the ground, baby, laying face down. I had blood trickling out of my mouth. I thought we'd never ever speak again until I got a message on my mobile phone saying, hey baby, can I come on over? I'm really sorry that I almost killed you. I'm really sorry that I almost killed you, baby. I'm really sorry that I almost killed you, baby. I took you back and then we hit the town. Drank from the bottle till we all passed out. Then I walked you home and you crossed the street. That's when the vultures, they came for me. And they scratched me and punched me, but I wouldn't give in, no. I kept my wallet in integrity. The last thing I saw were the soles of your feet, running away just like you always did. I'm really sorry that I almost killed you, baby. I'm really sorry that I almost killed you, baby. I'm really sorry that I almost killed you, baby.